Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 515. In this episode, Scott explores the creative process with comic creator and musician Afua Richardson.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I have the pleasure of talking with Afua Richardson. She's a comic artist and a musician and many, many, many creative things. And I'm so happy to be chatting with you today.
Thanks for having me.
So I first learned about you when I was recommended that I buy a copy of Genius, which is one of your books that was done, I think, through Top Cow Comics?
Absolutely, yes. It's a six-issue miniseries written by Mark Bernardin and Adam Freeman about a 17-year-old tactical genius that's born in South Central Los Angeles.
Tactical genius. So she's like a savant. She is beyond our abilities.
She's a war strategist, basically, and living in South Central, in one of the most dangerous parts of the United States, it's almost impractical. Like, what application would someone have? Maybe a Hannibal, someone who's born into a war or a conquering civilization would have an application for that. But she sees the possibilities, she sees the probability, and growing up in an area like I grew up in Harlem, so I could relate to the character. And my dad's a physicist. When you grow up in the hood, it's almost a it doesn't pay to be smart. Basically, it's looked down upon.
Well, they think it's an anachronism. It's just like, wait a second, you're not supposed to. That's not the role that we all assign to you.
Well, and it's not even something that's externally happening from someplace else. It's sort of within the community itself. If I speak properly, then I'm trying to speak like a white girl. I'm like, I'm not trying to speak like anything. This is just how I speak. But if you're a kid and you're growing up like this, it's looked at as if you're doing it to slight them. You know, like, so the character hid her intelligence. She would intentionally mark her papers wrong, because being smart just didn't pay. You get beat up, you get made fun of, and standing out in a situation where, you know, there are a lot of broken homes, broken families, broken philosophies means you'll be targeted, and it's not worth it.
And she uses this strategy first behind the scenes, and then in the front of the scenes when people start to realize that there's a new player in town, and starts moving chess pieces around.
Absolutely. She goes through a couple of transformations. Sorry for spoilers. but she starts to see that everyone's kind of being engineered. On the police side, they're sort of being used, you know, good men and women being used as dogs of the state to socially engineer people into being cannon fodder for a prison industrial complex. So people are being pitted against each other, and they just end up in jail, and that generates money for the state, you know, an average of like $27,000 per prisoner. And instead of coming together, you know, they're at each other's throats. So they're doing the job. They're just doing someone else's job. They're exterminating themselves. So she starts organizing them, removing leaders, and starts taking over square blocks of Los Angeles. And at the same time, sending in videos to the local media who, you know, we presume are free and open thinkers. And they They start to debate back and forth, like, okay, well, here are these corrupt police officers who are selling drugs to quote-unquote undesirable neighborhoods and destroying the people. No one's forcing them to take this, but if they're in a really bad, dire situation, they just want to forget, here, you know, there's some heroin that'll destroy you chemically. Mm. And so people are preying on each other, and so she's starting to realize that pattern and puts it on its head and says, hey, you know, let's stop fighting each other. Let's start taking back these neighborhoods. And so she starts, you know, this war campaign, taking over square blocks, setting up traps. And it was weird because I started seeing things like that happen in real life. There were six police officers who were tried arrested and tried for trafficking drugs in different neighborhoods. And it was weird because the lineup looked like the characters that I drew. It was kind of eerie. And also the Bloods and Crips, which were these gangs, and I don't know where they necessarily originated or if they were engineered or what. But they started coming together territory-wise because, you know, people think, oh, it's the Bloods and the Crips that are really at each other's throats. And there's so many other gangs and things like that. People just trying to form their own families and communities and ways to organize themselves. But the violence, where, you know, we don't know where it starts, why it starts, and why it keeps perpetuating. So she's just like, yeah, I'm putting the kibosh on that. Mm.
And all the while she's doing this, she's a teenager. She's a petite young black woman, not right. who you would expect to be listed along with Alexander the Great, Caesar, Hannibal, you know, like, but why right. shouldn't one of the great military strategists in history just pop up and be born in an environment we don't expect?
Absolutely. It happens all the time. And how often is that capability squashed? You know, not that I think it would be great for people to start.
But the idea that, you know, it's not always just old white dudes in Carthage that pop up with
right,
this kind of
right.
skill.
I mean, you kind of see it throughout history, even in a, I sort of hate to go only towards ancient Egypt because that sort of erases any of the advancements that, you know, the entire continent of Africa has accomplished in, you know, 5,000 years. But the first female pharaoh, Hatshepsut, I think that's how you pronounce her name, she, when her husband died, she took over as pharaoh, and she started implementing changes. She allowed women to represent themselves in court, and they could own property, and after she died, that was the end of that. They buried her in any legacy of her at all. But it absolutely exists. And I don't think it's a big grand conspiracy to suppress that. But I think a lot of times the mental barriers stop people from having the psychological permission to see themselves as certain archetypes. So they just sort of fall into where they think they can succeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Hatshepsut was actually one of the most successful pharaohs, considered one of the most successful pharaohs. And I think she ended up living into her 50s, which is quite significant given the time. She was long-lived for the time and very, very successful, and one of the most successful women of the early, you know, 1500 BC timeframe.
Right.
So, backing up a little bit, this is some pretty heavy stuff. The people who are listening might be saying, wait a second, I thought this was a comic artist that we've got here. Why do you think that people don't realize that really complicated themes can be talked about in the context of comics?
I think the way comics are approached is it's thought of as a child medium where they're superheroes, tights, superpowers, and very juvenile and kind of immature concepts, that very complicated things can't be expressed through these new, they're basically new gods. They're the new, like Superman is Horus, is Jesus. He's Neo. You know, you see the same sort of representations, the same archetypes over and over again. But I think in America, it's viewed as, you know, No one's taking that seriously. Mm-hmm. I did an interview with someone on the radio. They're like, no one's really taking comic books seriously. And I was like, Have you paid attention to any of the films?
What has every movie that has been successful in the last 5 years been about? Like, we clearly are interested in these new gods.
Absolutely, because they remind us about things in ourselves. We can see ourselves within them. It's sort of this heroic morale that people have without having to subscribe to a binding religion or a state delved out philosophy.
That's a really significant point that we should just kind of double click on, for lack of another word, for just a moment, because it's clear, like in the upcoming Batman versus Superman situation, that there's religious undertones in everything there, but you don't have to ascribe to a religion, nor do you have to feel that you're this is not an affront to your religion.
Yeah, exactly. People can believe whatever they want to. I feel like religion is an interface for people to interpret reality. Mm-hmm. And I don't presume to know anything with certainty. That's things that are accepted as fact change with technology all the time. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of the early religions and things, of course, were changed over the time by tyrants who wanted to usurp these principles. But I think fundamentally people needed metaphors in order to retain the information. Mm-hmm. You might not remember that on December 31st, the constellation Orion is followed by Virgo, and then from that point onward, after the winter solstice, the arc of the sun across the sky gets longer. But you might remember that three wise men, which is like the belt of Orion, mm-hmm. followed the Virgin, followed a star. Mm-hmm. And they found the Virgin, and then the sun was born. Like, literally, the constellation Virgo comes up over the horizon, and then the sun starts to get longer. Starts to get longer, but it stays longer in the sky. So the sun is born. It's reborn.
Right.
And that can be represented in so many ways, and it's not to discredit anyone's religion, but, you have to kind of look through time and see where many of these things were rewritten and changed and manipulated to fit a particular ruler's idea.
Right. Well, it reminds me of Joseph Campbell and the power of myth and the idea of the hero's journey. And, Luke Skywalker is Jason and the Argonauts. It's the story we've heard 1,000 times before.
Right.
There are only so many stories.
Right. Look at Superman. Grant Morrison talks about it in Super Gods, and I have to finish reading that book, but I have so many comics to draw. But it's, it's a really great book where he starts making the comparison between, Batman and Hades. He's the guardian of the underworld, and it's kind of like Pluto. Pluto is the planet that's furthest out. It's near the Oort cloud, I believe. Is that the Oort cloud or the Kuiper disk?
I think it's the Oort cloud.
It's the Oort cloud. So he's sort of guardian of all of these frozen, stationary, mm-hmm. dead bodies mm-hmm. that you have to kind of cross a sea to get to, mm-hmm. And Batman is kind of, he is in the underworld, but he doesn't kill any of them. He just sort of keeps them at bay.
Right.
And Jupiter is like Zeus hurling the thunderbolt, because when objects from, the Oort cloud come in, it's Jupiter's gravity that determines whether or not it goes towards the sun or away from the sun. So it's these same personifications of natural events that get repeated, and you see it in comic books, and that's why it resonates so much. Speaking of Luke Skywalker, my mom was Buddhist, and she would take us to a Buddhist temple when I lived in New York, and I saw Mark Hamill at the very front. We would pray, and we'd pray to this sort of scroll thing, and we'd repeat these sutras. And I didn't know what I was saying. It was in Japanese. So I'm sitting there chanting, like, all right, saying something. And I see Mark Hamill in the front, and I pull my mom's sleeve. I'm like, Mom! I thought Luke Skywalker was a Jedi. She's just like, it's okay. Like, he can be both. And I'm like, oh, okay. He can be both, you know, Buddhist and a Jedi. They can share philosophy. I was like, okay.
It is right, nice to remember that we can share philosophies. That's totally okay to do that.
We can. Like, it doesn't have to be so finite because, you know, we don't know, but we can try.
I was telling someone recently that I tend to watch a lot of TV. I unapologetically watch a lot of TV because I'm convinced that we are in the golden age of television. Like, you know, with like, you know, if you ever meet someone that like maybe hasn't seen The Wire or they haven't seen Breaking Bad,
right,
and you just want to like stop the conversation and just like slap them across the face and just say, what are you doing here? Why are you even talking to me? You should be home watching Breaking Bad. And I feel the same way about comics right now. Like, I feel like there's this resurgence, you know, and there's just so much great comics going on, like Miss Marvel and just on and on and on. Do you think that we are, like, is this the new golden age? Is this a new, is there a moment that's happening here?
I think people are coming to the actualization that different kinds of stories have been told in comics and that there's a market for it. And so with that understanding, and also with Joe Quesada selling the rights to the making of the Marvel movies, that has opened up a huge avenue. So people are seeing comics. Comics are basically now the new I want to direct. Because they see the audience that the diehard fans that will go out and support a title, that will support a character because, you know, it's a piece of them. It's a piece of themselves. And now that people are understanding, okay, we don't have to sell to just this particular demographic. We can make things for different kinds of people with different philosophies, different ideas, not even just different nationalities and or different ages, but you can make horror comics. You can make, you know, just superhero comics. Superhero comics are great. We know them. We love them. Like, we can reproduce them. We can make action drama. And that is a sort of a pre-storyboard and a test market for a film. And people with that, having that understanding, you know, they assume it's a fast track, but it's a lot of work.
Hey folks, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about Raygun and their new product called Pulse. Raygun is an error and crash reporting software provider, and their new product, Pulse, it's a real-time user monitoring product. It gives you performance data and user insights, lets you understand exactly what's happening when users interact with your software, so you're never left guessing. Raygun provides you with the answers to your performance questions, and they've found over 10 billion, that's billion with a B, bugs in customer apps with their crash reporting product. And now Raygun will help you understand application quality like no one else. Over 30,000 developers worldwide can't be wrong. I use Raygun all the time and I enjoy it very much. You can try it out today with a no-risk 30-day free trial. Start improving your software quality immediately. Try Raygun for free today at raygun.io.
Let me
dig into this a little bit, if you don't mind, and I hope this isn't too personal, because I feel like the movies that are making like $1 billion, you know what I mean? Like Avengers made like $1 billion, you know, like a billion is one of those words, you just have to hit the B and just like let it hang
right
there.
But, $1 billion.
But when I'm going to go to Wizard World in a couple of weeks, and I feel like I'm still seeing comic artists that are just talented beyond belief.
Yeah.
Sitting at a picnic table selling their art, and I get the impression that they don't have awesome healthcare and they're not living in mansions, but they are the creators of my heroes. Is the movies co-opting, almost, maybe co-opting isn't the right word, but making $1 billion movies about our heroes, is it leaving, I don't know, people like you behind? How do you get some of that billion?
Well, it depends on the ownership. If you think you can redraft Superman's costume and then make a bunch of money off of it, that's not necessarily how this goes. These properties are, I mean, they've been around since World War II. The way that an artist can make $1 billion is if they own the intellectual property.
Right.
You know, and a lot of times, you know, people can get screwed if they don't have the right representation, if they don't know what they're signing over, you know, so having that understanding is important. The artists are, many artists are freelance. So they're work for hire. There's no W-2. There's no taxes taken out. There are no health benefits. You have to kind of create that on your own. And so it's kind of a long and grueling process initially where you have to hone your craft, then make a name for yourself, then work on properties to show that you actually can hit a deadline and make something that's sellable and people want. Then you have to maybe, you know, some people get away with it, you know, not be a douchebag. And it's sort of like one out of three things, you know, they like you, you send in work on time, and, you know, you do good work.
Is it
two out of those three seem to work, but people get left behind when they don't know the business, when they don't know the business of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I'm still learning. There's still lots of things for me to learn. Mm-hmm. But with Genius, that was a work for hire. After I completed that and I got paid for my page rate, you know, it's being sold in Barnes & Noble. And I don't see any of that because I'm not, even though I created the characters and the aesthetic and, you know, made a few changes here and there, it's not my concept and it's not my story. So after I'm paid for that job, that's it. They own it. They can do what they want with it. If they would like to include me in the making of the film, that would be fantastic. But I'm not entitled to any of that because A, that wasn't written to my original contract. Right. And B, like I said, not the IP owner. So people think that because these properties make millions of dollars that comic artists are rich. More often than not, if they don't turn in work that is approved, they don't get paid.
Does that underscore the importance of what is also a bit of the rise of comic artist owned intellectual property, like these not the big Marvel DC, but like, you know, Kirkman and these different folks that are saying like artists should own their own stuff. Like, is that going to change, or are we splitting where there's going to be two kinds of comics, the big corporate comics and then the little people and nothing in between?
Well, I think with books like Saga, that's changing. You know, there are people who are moving outside of Marvel and DC, and they have great properties and great stories, and they can afford to hire the best of the best and have that team together and make an amazing book. But indie artists are finding a way to go directly to their audience and say, okay, this is what I have in mind. In order for me to live in the meantime of making this book, you know, I could really use your support. And now with things like Kickstarter and different social media platforms, people can decide, okay, you know what? I want to see that happen. I want to see that come into a reality. So I'm going to support this directly. Whereas maybe 10, 20, 30 years ago, that wasn't a reality. And that wasn't even possible. You couldn't have that sort of platform or access to the public in general. And both of those things can coexist. I think, you know, there will always be a place for the Marvels and DCs, but I think different kinds of stories can be told by different kinds of people that I think companies like Marvel can't necessarily facilitate because of the amount of initial investment. So with, for example, a book like X-Men, you have to consider average 20 to 30 pages.
Right.
The penciler, inker, and colorist, three different jobs. On average, you know, $100 to $200, $500, $600 a page. You know, everything varies according to level of experience. So you're looking at, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 for the production of one book.
Wow.
You've got to get that return on investment. That means that they can't make that kind of investment on a smaller book and then get a return if it's something that is a little bit more nuance and niche. But someone putting in an initial investment of $5,000 and getting a return of 10 or 20, that's something that an indie artist can benefit from. And also, when you think about it, DC has Vertigo, and that's their avenue to tell their independent stories. Marvel doesn't currently have that. You know, so they're using, when they put in new characters, they're inserting them into their universe.
Interesting. Yeah, and you're right. That is the model that most, even movie theaters, production houses, right? They'll have like the big, you know, new age cinema, which is like, you know, the arm of a larger organization.
Mm-hmm.
So you described three different jobs there: penciler, inker, and colorist. Those are the jobs that I think of historically. I remember, you know, when I was, you know, probably 20 years ago, buying, you know, the Become a Comic Artist kits with the giant pages, you know, and you learn all about those individual jobs. And we were always taught that they were separate. But now with the advent of digital, you are all three of those things, aren't you?
Yes. I'm working on a Marvel book right now, and this is the first time I'll be doing just pencils and inks. Because it does take a lot of time, and I'm trying to use new programs because historically I've used Adobe Illustrator, which, if anyone's used Illustrator, it's more of a graphic design program because that's kind of how I started out as a graphic designer and just someone who loved comics and taught themselves how to draw in these programs. But I guess now if you can draw by hand and digitally, you have an advantage.
Mm.
Honestly, with these different types of programs, vector programs, Manga Studio, Illustrator, Sketchbook Pro, people are drawing on their tablets now. You can sort of circumvent those things, but they're not obsolete.
Mm.
There are some people who are just inkers, and they're really, really good at that. And that's still necessary for those who are just pencilers. But if you can do all three, you can probably get through a book a little bit faster.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for a company, if they can hit their mark, then you can pay them for all three jobs.
Uh-huh. Okay. So being all three of those isn't necessarily an opportunity for someone to get ripped off. Like, you're not going to say, I'm going to get paid twice as much rather than three times as much, even though I'm doing three times the work.
Sometimes it ends up happening that way. We're like, oh, you're doing all of those? Okay, well, we'll give you this much per page. It's like, wait, that doesn't add up to very much at all. Okay.
It's so interesting, though, that from the outside looking in, that you keep saying per page, and that's so turn the crank. You know what I mean? It's almost like me being paid per lines of code, as opposed to per program that I write. You know, like there's the end product. It may be 10 lines of code, maybe 1,000, but the end product is, you know, quite, like you might look at someone else's art and you might find in just chatting with them that, oh, wow, it takes you like 14 hours a page. Oh, I bang out a page in 9 hours or whatever.
Right.
You know, and we have this myth within programming of the 10x programmer. The idea of like, you know, there are certain kinds of programmers that are 10 times more productive than others. And we don't know. It's, you know, it's a myth. You know, I assume that you might have the same myth with comic artists, where there's certain people that produce at a level that you can't even understand how they're pulling it off.
Yeah, there's some people who create a lot faster than others. I want to get faster just for my own edification. So, especially being self-taught, there are a lot of things I had to kind of learn the hard way.
Oh.
Yeah, like I traditionally started off as a cover artist because being a singer and a voice actor, I would perform at different places and I would make my own flyers. And then I started doing album covers because out of a circle of many musicians, I would be the only artist that they knew personally. So they were like, hey, you know, I have $600. Can you just make an album cover for me? And I'm like, I can do that. All right. Sure. But it's, you can't treat individual panels of a page, which are just showing moments, which are showing like the apex of a moment, moving the story along like a cover.
Mm.
You can't cram all that information into a single frame. And if you try to do so, you'll take all day because the information doesn't translate quite as well. It's smaller. There's less detail. If you put too much detail into it, the eye's not going to know where to go. If you think of detail like information and it's information to be read, the eye will travel across the page in the direction of darks and like blacks, darks, and detail.
Mm-hmm.
So how you communicate that on a page moves the person along in the story.
Wow. Okay. So it's the you know how when you're watching a movie and they'll cut to someone and they're looking in one direction and then they'll cut to the other person and they're looking the other direction. Like that's the kind of stuff the director's thinking about where
yes.
if both people were looking to the right, even though they're supposed to be talking to each other, because if that's how they set the cameras up, it would, you wouldn't know what was wrong. But you would know
right.
something was wrong. Your brain would say, what's going on? You'd be incorrectly oriented in your brain. So you're thinking about right. that flow as you move through the pages.
Absolutely. And also, you know, you have to kind of think of the, not just the cinematography of the individual panels mm. as it is relaying information, but the flow of where things are positioned and how it leads people across the page. So you're thinking about, you're kind of a director in that sense when you're a comic artist, you can set up the information and each panel tells a piece of the story and moves it along.
Mm-hmm.
And for indie creators, if you're putting something in a story and it doesn't either reveal something about the character or give more information, you might want to consider cutting it. So that's sort of the helpful part of an editor. They will tell you when you've got too much going on.
Mm. You mentioned that you did voiceover work. You're also a singer. You're a songwriter. You're
yes.
an accomplished flautist. you know, there's only so many hours in the day.
I forfeited my social life.
Should you? I mean, I don't imagine like after a day of writing comics and drawing and doing all this work, and then you're like, oh, I think I'll go to the local club and then I will join my band. I mean, how do you have the energy to do all those kind of things? Do you ever feel the need to pick one?
I do sometimes. And when I do, I get fundamentally sick.
Really?
I do. I do. Something in me just kind of goes a little sour if I'm not doing one of those things. Now, granted, comics takes a lot more time. And because I'm a self-taught artist, I have to spend more time to focus on it.
Mm-hmm.
And as a musician, you know, I've been playing the flute since I was 9. I, you know, performed on a bunch of different stages. I got to tour with some amazing folks and I sort of taught myself how to sing after doing a lot of like reading a lot of sheet music and things like that. I beatboxed for a while, which is kind of weird. I was with a lot of like female underground hip hop crews where they were like break dancers and beatbox.
Yeah.
I was the only beatbox artist, but they were MCs and so on. So I was their resident beatbox artist for this group called
nice.
The Anomalies. And I started mimicking singers. It's just another sound, you know, I do like animal noises and beats and things like that. And I would, you know, like, once upon a time, there's a story out of time, you know, like I kind of mimic jazz singers mm-hmm. and mimic these different things until I eventually became one. And, I think sometime when I was, you know, 16 or 17, my folks were having a hard time and they just kind of went in two different directions and I was sort of on my own. And so I had to take on a lot of odd jobs and, I was performing a couple of times a week. So it was more out of necessity, like, all right, I need to know how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I would play my flute in different bands and sing background and eventually went on tour. But I had office jobs that had computers, so I taught myself Photoshop.
Uh-huh. It seems like, if I may, that there's a thematically through your career, through your work, through your life, you're putting on different masks.
That's very true.
But all in the process of not hiding, but to figure out who you are. But it must be both very frustrating because you have all these masks to pick from. Well, some people may just have one, but also it must also be very, very empowering to feel that when you're tired of one, you can switch to another.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I'm in a band called Waking Astronomer, and I'm the singer and flute player, and I beatbox in the band. And it's been really great because, you know, they're weirdos like me, and I can sort of be myself, you know, as a singer. You know, I thought I had to go through the channels of okay, I write some songs, I get a record contract, I go on tour, and that's how you become a successful singer. Mm. But when I started navigating through the industry, you know, of course I was immature and I wasn't really ready, but what I noticed was that it was more of an assembly line. It was a little bit more about, okay, can you make a hit song? Okay, pretend to be this other person, be an MC. You know, I was really big into rock. Like I love Stone Temple Pilots. Like that was my everything, and Red Hot Chili Peppers. And so I wanted to do rock, and I came from a jazz and classical background, so I could appreciate a lot of different kinds of music. And, you know, excuse my English when I say this, but I literally had someone tell me like, yeah, well, you could do all that White Devil shit later. You gotta like get some street cred first. And I was like, what? Okay. I just want to make the music that I want to make.
Right.
I decided, well, you know, if I am going to do music, I'll just do it on my terms. And, so I kind of figured, well, you know, maybe that just won't happen. With art, I can tell the stories that I want to tell, and I can express myself that way. When I was a kid, I wasn't very talkative, and I felt like I almost couldn't trust my own thoughts or my own words. But playing the flute so young, that enabled me to have a voice that couldn't be questioned other than the technique.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, okay, you know, I can trust this because this is in tune. This is in tune and this is correct. You know, the intonation is correct. I'm expressing this the way I want to. I've hit the notes and I've practiced this, and no one can take this from me. No one can, you know, you can critique it, but you can critique my technique, not who I am.
Right. It's a true meritocracy.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was really important for me. That was really vital for me, because I did not have a very healthy bout of self-esteem. Because a lot of things happened in my life, and it made me feel like, well, why did this happen to me? You know, maybe I don't deserve to be happy. And just all these things that that person tells themselves to try and rationalize tragedy. And when you can make art and change your mind and inspire someone else, you want to make it to the best of your ability. And so I just kept pushing, and I, even though people told me it was a waste of time, you know, don't do this, get a real job, you're going to be homeless maybe for the rest of your life, or just so many fears that people projected onto me, like, yeah, you're never going to make it. You're too old to do this.
Hmm.
And even though it's hard, you know, life is hard. Life is difficult. Surviving is difficult. We might as well do something that we enjoy, that at the end of it, after it's finished, you can look back and say, you know what? I made this. I made this, and it's there, and it's not perfect, but who cares? I finished it. I accomplished it. It's published. And maybe someone else will appreciate it. Because when I would listen to music, sometimes, you know, my head would be so cloudy. And then when I would hear the construction of these songs and their chords and their progressions, I was like, you know what? This person, they're going through something. They're struggling. They're doing whatever they're doing in their life, but they were able to make this. And this is beautiful. So I want this, and I want this for somebody else. And I want them to know that, you know, I'm not a superhero. Like, I'm not special, but I'm too stubborn to quit. I'm too stubborn to cave in, because we've got this one life. We might come back. We don't know. We don't have any memory of what we were before, be it dirt, be it ether, be it another person. But we have this experience, and we're always waiting. We're always waiting until we're ready. We're waiting until the right moment. And those moments pass. And I want people to be able to embrace the things that they want to make with their lives now, and to try it. And, you know, everybody's not going to, a million people want to draw Spider-Man. They're not going to be able to draw Spider-Man. They're not going to have the opportunity to draw Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that, you know, if you think it's possible, but at the same time, it is. I never thought, you know, sleeping on a subway that I would have the opportunity to draw for a living. You know, I just thought that just didn't happen for someone like me. And that's not necessarily to say, you know, as a black woman, because I get that a lot. Like, how does it feel to be a black woman in a white male dominated industry? And I was like, it's fine. You know, I don't make it an issue. I make my work speak for me. Mm. If I want to see something, if I feel like there aren't enough people of this particular type of culture being represented, I'm not going to look to someone else to make it. That's my job. That's an opportunity. And I think with comics lately, there have been a lot of people complaining, but not enough people supporting, or people trying it themselves, or doing the research to understand what really goes into it. It takes a lot of heart and a lot of effort, and I put my everything into my artwork, and because it's me on a page.
Mm. Well, people can check you out on a page at afuarichardson.info. So you've got your music up there. You've got mm-hmm. events that you go to, conventions. Yes. There's the Foo store. You can mm-hmm. check out, and you can also check out your new album, correct?
Yes, a self-titled EP, 8 songs. It's available for streaming on OK Player right now. It's called Waking Astronomer.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you can visit afuarichardson.com or follow me on Twitter. Tumblr. I have a group on Facebook called Dr. Foo's Lab.
Nice.
I got that nickname from Brandon Graham, who's a really, really great comics creator. Yeah, it's sort of an art community, because that's something that I know I wouldn't have survived without, having a community of people who can give me feedback mm-hmm. and encourage me, but also let me know when I'm lagging. It's kind of like a dojo, and it's a really great art family there. So anyone who's an aspiring artist or a professional, you know, come on down, come join us.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for spending time with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for listening, everybody.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.